Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this e-learning. This is April's e-learning, and today's topic is You Be the Judge. For some of our existing clients, you have probably kind of seen this topic before, and you're excited. It is a great topic, which I'll explain momentarily. But before we get started, just a few reminders, as always. If you have any questions at all during the presentation, please feel free to use the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen to type them out. We will do our best to answer them during the presentation, but if for some reason we don't get a chance to answer them, we will be sure to follow up with you following the presentation. Also, in case you've missed any of our past webinars, you can find the recordings over at e2rsolutions.com, and the PowerPoint presentations can be found on your member portal. Lastly, please be advised that the information that we are talking about in today's webinar and all of our webinars is an overview only and is not intended to be a legal analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and therefore should not be relied upon as legal advice. If you have any specific questions, please reach out to us and we will address those individually. Mark your calendars. Next month's e-learning is going to be a good one. It's on May 29th, and we'll be discussing all things recruitment and interviewing. I'll be taking a seat on the bench that one. It's going to be hosted by one of our lead HR advisors and our recruitment specialist, so you're going to get some serious knowledge on recruitment and interviewing next month. So let's get started on today's e-learning. So it's you be the judge. And so we have a quick agenda here. We're going to go through essentially a bunch of recent case law that are going to touch on the following overarching issues. So there's off-duty conduct and just cause. We're going to go through issues related to employment references. We're going to highlight a recent case about mitigation and some of the obligations that may arise there. We're going to address fixed-term employment contracts and why you should proceed with caution on those. We're going to go through a couple of examples to determine whether or not the employment agreement in the case protects the employer, and if not, why not? We're going to also highlight some areas where you may have to do an investigation and when you might not have to do a workplace investigation. We're also going to then address another issue, which is called after acquired cause. So sit tight. It's going to be a fun one. And the reason why we're doing this, obviously, is because litigation is uncertain. And so we have canvassed some recent case law to highlight the examples of that. And things often are gotten wrong by kind of different levels of our courts. And so things are very fact specific. And things can be overturned and litigation is uncertain. And the more knowledge you know about each area of employment law, the better equipped you'll be to make the right choice beforehand so you don't end up in litigation. And so our goal today is to highlight those cases and those mistakes and those issues so you have a better understanding of where employment law is going today. Oh, I'm also joined by my colleague who's joining me today. Her name is Alexandra. I'm sure many of you have spoken with her before, and she's going to address our first set of cases, I guess.
Perfect. Thank you for that introduction, the two Alexes today. So the first topic is, does off-duty conduct amount to just cause? And we're going to discuss kind of two hypotheticals. The first case, this was a case out of BC. The employee was an assistant fire chief with 13 years of service. While he was off duty, he was driving home after a date night with his wife, and he was pulled over by the RCMP while driving an unmarked vehicle belonging to his employer. He failed a roadside breathalyzer twice, and the officer impounded the vehicle and issued the employee a 90-day administrative driving prohibition. So the employee took this seriously. He reported it immediately to his employer. And upon the employer being notified that he was unable to drive for 90 days, he was terminated for just cause. This is on the basis that his conduct was not compatible with his duties, in particular his responsibility to ensure public safety, as well as the potential liability to taxpayers. The employee had no prior disciplinary record. The question is, did the employer have just cause to terminate the employee for his off-duty conduct? So, take a moment. The answer is, if you guess that the employer had just cause to terminate the employee, you're wrong. In finding that the employer did not have just cause, the court noted the following. The vehicle the employee was driving was not marked as a city vehicle, so there was no way the general public would know that it was a vehicle, the city's vehicle. There was no public knowledge of the employee's administrative driving suspension, and the employee held a more administrative role as opposed to a public-facing role. The court also considered that the police officer had imposed an administrative license suspension on the employee instead of a criminal charge. What's also interesting in this case is that the fire department and employees of the fire department signed a letter of support for the employee, and the court noted that if the conduct did not cause a loss of confidence on behalf of his peers, then it was difficult to conclude that members of the public would also lose confidence. The judge found that the employer did not have just cause and awarded the employee termination pay based off of the termination clause in his employment agreement, which amounted to 5 months. So this case highlights the importance of proceeding with caution when relying on off-duty conduct to support a termination for cause. So remember that when always consider what prejudice, if any, to the interests or reputation of the company have arisen from the conduct, and always consider specifically the employee's actual duties, role, and their employment history.
Our next off-duty case involves an employee who was a general laborer who was arrested while at work and charged with 2 counts of sexual assault against minors. So a very serious allegation and criminal charge. So the employer met with that employee the following day, but the employee refused to address the criminal charges on the basis that the events that he was being charged with did not occur at the workplace and did not involve any of the other employees. After which, one of the other employees, who was a female employee, approached the employer and identified some concerns around the fact that she was a distant relative of the employee who was charged, and she used to visit him with her family, and she alleged that she had stopped those visits because he had made some sexual comments and advances towards her in the past. Then the employer met with the employee and brought up the complaint made by the other employee who was related to him distantly. The employee who was charged again said, no one was involved at work with my criminal charges. I'm not going to discuss those with you. And based upon that information, the employer decided to terminate him for just cause on the basis of the criminal charges, and the employee then sued for wrongful dismissal. Obviously, the question for the court was, did the employer have just cause to terminate the employee based upon the serious criminal charges that were levied against him? So just take a moment and think about what you think a judge would say in that scenario. We're going to flip the side to that. And so if you guessed that the employer did not have just cause to terminate the employee, you're right. So the court confirmed what Alexandra mentioned earlier, that off-duty conduct alone does not give rise for just cause for dismissal. If we're looking at the ability to support a just cause termination for off-duty conduct, there must be a justifiable connection between the off-duty conduct and the employer or the company or the nature of the employment. In this particular case, there are no employees involved in the criminal charge except for the individual who was actually charged. The court said there's no nexus between the workplace and the charges. The court went further to say that the employer would suffer no reputational harm because the employee was just a general laborer, not an executive or someone in a management role. Now, I would disagree with that, perhaps, but that's what the court found. They also highlighted, too, that there is this idea of the presumption of innocence. So we're not going to automatically assume that the employee has done these awful things simply because they have been kind of charged criminally with that. And so ultimately, the key takeaway from both of these cases is that it's hard for an employer to rely upon off-duty conduct to support a termination for cause unless there is a justifiable or a nexus between what the employee has done in their own time and the workplace. So either there is a risk, a significant risk, or a provable risk of reputational harm, or there is a connection between the charge and the employment relationship. So one example I can think of is if an employee is charged with fraud and they are your accounting person, for example, well, then at least there is a nexus between the charges and the job duties. But in this particular case that I talked about, it was a general laborer who was charged with something that was unrelated to his company and to his actual job duties. So the court found that they didn't have just cause.
Okay. And keep in mind with those cases that that's just in relation to a just cause termination. And then an employee, like for example, in this example where there were serious like criminal charges, the employer likely would have been able to terminate on a without cause basis. But he just didn't have enough to assert cause. The next topic is, can I be honest employment references? And this is a question that we get a lot, and we're going to chat about a case that deals with this subject matter. So, an employee worked for a company for 5 years, and after being laid off from her former employer, and the employer received a conditional offer of employment subject to a reference check. Very normal. The prospective employer called the employee's former direct supervisor, who gave her a glowing recommendation. The direct supervisor passed along the name of a colleague, Mr. Riggin, who had further experience managing the employee. Mr. Riggin told the prospective employer that the employee did not take direction well, was narrowly focused, handled stress poorly, and that he would not rehire her in her formal role. Ouch. So needless to say, after receiving that not so glowing recommendation, the prospective employer advised the employee that she had failed to meet the conditions of employment because of the negative reference. The employee then sued Mr. Riggin for defamation. The employee argued that Mr. Riggin was motivated to make these unflattering statements about her by malice, spite, and a desire for revenge. So the question now becomes, did the court find that Mr. Riggin was liable for his negative but honest employment reference? Take a moment, give us a thought. Perhaps you've spoken to us about this issue before. The answer is, if you answered no, he wasn't liable, you were right. So at trial, Mr. Riggin admitted to making some of the comments and qualified others, and having determined that the words spoken by Mr. Riggin were defamatory, the court then considered whether those comments were subject to qualified privilege. The trial judge and the Ontario Court of Appeal both confirmed that the statements were protected under qualified privilege. The trial judge stated that the social policy underpinning the protection of employment references in this manner is clear. An employer must be able to give a job reference with candor as to the strengths and weaknesses of an employee without fear of being sued in defamation for doing so. Without this protection, references would either not be given or would be given with such edited content as to render them at best unhelpful or at worst misleading to the prospective employer. So basically the judge said, due to social policy reasons, you know, people need to be able to rely on references. So this is why those references need to be protected by qualified privilege. The qualified privilege can be defeated and liability for defamation can arise only where the statements are false and malicious. And they confirm that Mr. Riggin's reference is not malicious. The employee tried at trial to point to 3 workplace incidents where she had allegedly embarrassed Mr. Riggin, so the court rejected those claims and found that Mr. Riggin did not have any ill will against her. So this is a reminder that you can be comfortable giving honest reviews about current or former employees to a prospective employer, provided that the comments are honestly held and not motivated by malice. As like a friendly reminder, just be aware about any contextual circumstances or history that may suggest like a vengeful intent or ill will on the part of the individual providing the reference. So if I was a manager and there had been an employee, the former employee had like launched complaints against me in the past, I would probably shy away from giving that reference and have somebody else at the company give one. And I would also always recommend trying to balance some of the negative comments with a few positive. I think that can also mitigate against any risk of being found to be against having malice.
Speaking of mitigating, our next area of law that we're going to talk about here is mitigation, and in particular, an employee's right to mitigate their way. And so, briefly, before I delve into the facts here, I want to give you a quick understanding of what mitigation is. So when we terminate someone without just cause, if there is an entitlement to reasonable notice, so not in their contract, unless their contract specifies mitigation, but we're looking at someone who's terminated, they're owed reasonable notice, so those are called wrongful dismissal damages. An employee has an obligation to take steps to minimize those damages by looking for a new job. And if they are successful, then our exposure for that wrongful termination is going to be less than it otherwise would have been. Likewise, if an employee does not look for a new job and sits there and watches Maury Povich, I don't know if Maury Povich is on TV anymore, but something like that, stays home all day, takes no actions whatsoever to mitigate their losses, then a court is able to reduce the amount of reasonable notice that they otherwise would have awarded. In this particular kind of fact scenario we have here, kind of right before the person was kind of let go, she was granted a one-year educational leave to pursue certain extracurricular education. And so when she returned from that leave, she was let go by her employer. The employer offered her a 10-month kind of salary continuance package, which was conditional upon a couple of things. One, that she conduct a reasonable job search, so she didn't stay at home and do nothing all day, and that if she obtained a new job, any of the earnings that she received from that new job would be offset from the salary continuance arrangement. 3 months after her termination, she obtained an offer of full-time work. Yippee. However, she decided on her own accord not to accept the full-time job, but only work part-time so she could keep up with her outside educational pursuit. Former employer rightfully said, we're not going to pay the difference between the part-time wage and the salary continuance because we believe you are obligated to accept the full-time role offered to you as part of this duty to mitigate. The employee alternatively argued that it was reasonable for her to continue her educational pursuits and that she was entitled to the difference in pay. So the question for the judge in this case was there an obligation on the part of the employee to accept the full-time work, or was the employer in fact obligated to pay the difference between her part-time earnings and the salary continuance she was receiving? So let's take a minute to think about that. And if you said that the employee failed to mitigate, thankfully, you're right. Logic kind of prevailed here. So the court said that the employee was free to accept the part-time employment arrangement, but that the employer wasn't obligated to fund her desire to seek additional education. Ultimately, as I mentioned earlier, the duty to mitigate requires a former employee to take steps that a reasonable person would take in their own interest to maintain their income and position in the industry, trade, or profession. So they got to take active steps to look for new work, and if they are able to secure that, then that is mitigation. In this case, the educational path that the employee was on was a personal choice. It wasn't required in order to mitigate. There are some cases out there that we do need to be mindful of, that where an employee spends some time looking for a job in their area of expertise and is unable to secure employment in a reasonable period of time, that if they do pursue alternative education or licensing, et cetera, that may be a reasonable kind of effort to mitigate because they need to expand the scope of jobs that they're looking for. But in this case, that wasn't at all in play here. There's also some other cases that we also want to be mindful of too, that where an employee has spent some reasonable time looking for a job in their area of expertise and is unsuccessful, they are able to claim potentially mitigation damages against the former employer for things like the costs associated with obtaining new licensing or new education, or even in fact moving from one city to another city in order to mitigate. And so if you want more information on that, we'd be happy to go through that with you. I did do a nice article for Employment Law Today that kind of delved kind of really deep into this issue recently. I'm happy to share that with you as well. But ultimately, the key takeaway is employees have to mitigate, and that's their obligation. And if they are given the opportunity to do so, then they're going to be on the short end of the stick if they don't. So let's keep that in mind, especially when we get kind of those demand letters from the lawyers asking for all this notice. One of the key things we're going to want to go back for is what have they done in order to mitigate their losses.
Okay, so the next topic is fixed-term employment. So in this case, the employee was hired on a five-year fixed-term contract as a truck shop manager. The employee transferred to a position of sales development manager less than a year later. Roughly 2 years after he commenced employment, the employee was terminated without cause and was advised that he would be provided 2 weeks of pay. Now, in the employee's employment contract, it had an early out clause, which provided, in part, that employment may be terminated at any time by the employer, and any amounts paid to the employee shall be in accordance with the ESA. The employee alleged that this provision, this early out provision, was unenforceable for violating the ESA, and that he was entitled to be paid out the remaining term, and that he was not required to account for any mitigation income. So he basically argued that because it was fixed term, a five-year fixed term contract, he was entitled to the wages he would have earned in the remaining term. So it would have been like three more years. And Alex just discussed mitigation previously. He basically said if he got another job, any new income that he received wouldn't be offset against the damages. So the court was tasked with deciding whether the termination provision in the employment agreement was unenforceable, and if it was he entitled to 3 years of pay without an obligation to mitigate? Okay, take a moment, and the answer is yes and yes. So if you answered that, pat yourself on the back. So unfortunately for the employer, both the trial judge and the Court of Appeal found the language in the termination clause was ambiguous regarding the true extent of the employee's entitlement. So initially, the trial judge held that common law reasonable notice was applicable, but the Court of Appeal said, no way, he's entitled to the end of the term. The Court of Appeal judge said, where an employment agreement states unambiguously that the employment is for a fixed term, the employment relationship automatically terminates at the end of the term without any obligation to the employer to provide notice or payment in lieu of notice. However, if the parties to a fixed-term employment contract do not specify a predetermined notice period, an employee is entitled on early termination to the wages the employee would have received to the end of the term. So that obviously proves to be quite costly for the employer. Worse yet, the Court of Appeal confirmed that the employer did not have to account for any mitigation income. That's unfortunate. The key point from this case is that ensure that your termination provisions are bulletproof, particularly in a fixed-term contract. They need to be drafted clearly. They can't violate minimum employment standards. You always have to have an early termination provision. So basically, you want the provision to expressly state that in the event it's terminated prior to the end of the term, you're not on the hook to pay for the rest of the term, as well as limiting the employee to the Employment Standards Act and all of that. A note about Quebec. Courts in Quebec will not allow an employer to rely upon an early termination provision in a fixed-term employment agreement, even if it's drafted properly. So if you're in Quebec, just don't do it.
Yeah,
No fixed-term employment agreements in Quebec, please.
So let's look at another employment agreement and see whether or not it was enforceable or not. So in this case, the employee was a GM of a casino, and he told the board of directors, rightfully, that all the casino employees should have employment contracts. Maybe he got some rights from us, which we always advise. We want all the employees to be on employment contracts for the employer's protection. The board agreed with the GM and allowed the GM to draft all of the contracts for the employees and a contract for himself. There were major differences between the contract the GM drafted for himself and for the other employees. In particular, the GM's own contract was for a 7-year fixed term and stipulated that if he was terminated without cause earlier, he would be owed the compensation for the balance of the contract. So not as if the contract was silent on what would happen if terminated early. This expressly said, if you terminate me early, I get paid out the balance of my contract. The board agreed and signed off on the contract. 3 years down the road, the employee was terminated without cause. The employee then argued that he was entitled to be paid for the remaining 4 years of his contract, all the way up to the expiry date. The board refused to pay out the contract and argued that the contract was unenforceable. Now, question for you is, did the judge find that the employee was entitled to compensation for the remaining term, or was the contract unenforceable? So I'll frame that in a way that you can answer either yes or no. So did the judge kind of find that the remaining term was owed? Think about that. The answer is, if you answer no, the remaining term was not owed, you were correct. So in this particular case, the judge found that the employment contract was void for lack of consideration. That's something that you hear from us a lot. And it's a general principle in employment law and contract law, for that matter, that in order for there to be a binding contract, there must be offer, acceptance, and this idea of consideration. And what consideration is, it is something of value going from one party to the other in exchange for the contract, so it is bound together. Now, more often than not, that argument is used against the employer. In this case, as you'll see from the last point there, it was used in favor of the employer. And the reason why the court found comfortable kind of relying upon that argument is because the individual GM breached his fiduciary duty to the casino, and the board members who signed off on the contract breached their fiduciary duties. What that means is those two people on the board as a group and the GM owed a duty to do what is in the best interest of the company. And by entering into a contract for 7 years without an early termination provision, that was not in the best interest of the company. That was a breach of their fiduciary duties. And so they found that the contract wasn't a proper contract. And in fact, if I recall correctly, in this case, some of the board members were either family members or friends of the GM. And so there was some suspicion that it was just passed when it shouldn't have been passed. Because any normal board member would have said, wait a minute, this is not a good deal. Not a good deal for us as a company. We're not going to go into that. So they held that the rest of the term wasn't owed, but it was owed kind of some damages because there was a breach of contract in the sense that his employment was ended, and therefore they awarded him roughly 4.5 months of notice because of his termination. So obviously a very unique set of facts here, but just something to keep in mind and just an interesting case in any event. So.
Okay, next we're going to discuss two cases that kind of consider whether or not the employer had an obligation to conduct an investigation. The first one dealt with a termination of a director of finance and administration, actually worked for Habitat for Humanity, terminated as a result of restructuring. After the employee was terminated, she emailed the CEO about a month later, stating that she was discriminated against in the past weeks and asked the company to open an independent investigation into the discrimination case immediately. So following this troublesome email, the senior human resources director met with the employee to find out more about the allegations. During the meeting, the employee asked for her job back, but did not provide any further details about the allegations. The employer did not reinstate the employee, nor did the employer conduct an independent investigation. So the employee filed a claim for damages arising from her termination, discrimination, and the failure of the employer to investigate the allegations. And the question for you is, did the judge find that the employer had an obligation to conduct an investigation into the employee's allegations? Yes or no? You said no, the employer did not have an obligation to investigate. You are correct. The judge held that the employee had not provided any particulars of the alleged discrimination, and therefore the employer did not have a duty to investigate. Basically, she didn't say anything in that meeting which would allow them to conduct an fulsome investigation. So how could they reasonably be expected to commence an investigation? The judge accepted evidence from the employer and was satisfied that the termination was a result of the restructuring, as well as gaps in the employee's accounting skills and credentials required for the position. So that was all accepted at trial. At trial, the employee tried to argue that when she had said in her emails that she had been discriminated against in the past weeks, she was referring to comments from 2009, not that the employer would have known. She said that she had not specified to HR the particulars of her discrimination claim because she was uncomfortable raising such particulars directly with her former employer, which is why she had asked for an independent investigation. The judge dismissed this and said that the employee's justification that she was uncomfortable just didn't make sense because she had already was sufficiently comfortable to make the general allegation in the two emails. As a result, the judge found there was no obligation on the employer to conduct the investigation based on the steps it had already taken and the lack of information available related to the alleged discrimination claim. The key takeaways is always take steps to find out more details about the allegations of harassment or discrimination. Even though her employment had already been terminated and they received the email like a month after the fact, the company here did the right thing. They still met with her. They gave her a chance to explain the basis of her allegations. And because she didn't raise anything, at that point, they decided not to do anything further. The finding in this case may have been different if they had failed to have that meeting with her. So if there's an allegation, always try to get more information first, and then you go from there.
Yeah, so we can't just simply rely upon the fact that she didn't say anything in the first email go around. There is an obligation to dig a little deeper, just like Alexandra said, and because they held that meeting and she still refused to give any details and in fact just kind of tried to use the allegation in general to leverage her job back, then at that point the employer did all they were required to do in order to get those facts, and she decided not to go forward with it, kind of by like her own, on like her own means. So our next case regarding the duty to investigate involves an employee who informed her supervisor that a fellow employee deliberately elbowed her, and when she confronted him about the elbow, he denied elbowing her and told her to take a pill. Not very nice, but that's what happened. A couple days later, that same employee was trying to access a drawer that was being blocked by the other same employee. In response to being asked for the access to the drawer, the employee became angry and said, "Can you not wait?" or words to that effect. The employee then went back to her direct supervisor and said, "I tried to access the drawer and the guy was rude to me," et cetera, et cetera. On the 22nd of December, sorry, before the Christmas holidays, the employee met with the owner and said that she needs some time away from work to deal with these two things. And the owner said that she had the following day off work, which was the last day of their working year, and that they would figure it out in the new year. On the 28th of December, so before the new year, the employee received a termination letter. And we reproduced and some of that letter here because it's important context. In that letter, it says, on December 22nd, 2016, you were at the retail corner and wanted access to a drawer that your fellow employee was standing in front of. You lost your temper and angrily ranted against the employee while he was serving a customer. You have reacted in this unprofessional manner on other occasions and have been reprimanded for it. I cannot and will not condone this type of behavior. Obviously, in this case, the individual did not agree with that assessment and sued for wrongful dismissal. But more than that, she also sued for aggravated and punitive damages for the employer's failure to investigate her complaint. So the question for the judge in this case was there an obligation to conduct an investigation into the employee's allegations? And if so, what damages would be the appropriate remedy? Think about what you would think a judge would say. And if you answered yes to the first question, that there was a duty to investigate, you nailed it. So the judge found that the employee was harassed in the workplace, and the employer, rather than investigating, took the easy route and just let the employee go. On the judge found, and we quote here, the employer's conduct was malicious, oppressive, and high-handed, and must be deterred. The judge did not comment upon the nature of the workplace harassment, only that it had occurred. As a result of the judge's finding that the employer failed to investigate and took the easy way out, they awarded $10,000 as punitive damages. So essentially, those damages are meant as a punishment for kind of bad conduct on behalf of an employer. So it shows that if we don't investigate a complaint, there is the possibility that a court will award extra monetary damages because we didn't do the right thing. In this case as well, they awarded the individual 3 months of reasonable notice because there wasn't any just cause to terminate her. And then they also ordered an extra $20,000 in the manner in which she was actually let go. So they framed it as if she was the person who engaged in the negative behavior as opposed to the person who raised the harassment complaint.
And around Christmas. No less.
So just a friendly reminder, in most jurisdictions, occupational health and safety legislation does require employers to adequately investigate complaints of harassment. Those pieces of legislation and the case law also make clear that employers are not allowed to retaliate against employees who report being harassed. So no matter how trivial the harassment complaint is, and we've seen a lot of those recently, it's still, as long as the complaint is made in good faith, meaning it's not completely false or malicious, it should be investigated and some conclusions should be reached, and employees should not be punished for bringing forward a good faith complaint, even if it's not harassment. And just a very good example of where an employer may go wrong to try to deal with something easier than the route that they're supposed to go on. In this case, it became very, very costly to the employer. So just keep that in mind.
Okay, we're coming to the end of the presentation, making excellent time. We have a bonus case, and this case deals with a really, really fascinating concept in employment law called after acquired just cause. So in this case, the employee worked from 2007 to 2010 as the assistant vice president of campus service and building operations at York University. Over the course of his employment, the employee misappropriated $1 million from the university through false invoicing and inflated quotations. He used a portion of these funds to renovate his personal residence And he actually even used the university employees to perform renovations on his own home at the employer's expense. So pretty awful. In late January 2010, a whistleblower came forward alleging that the employee had misappropriated university resources. The employee denied the allegations, and quite frankly, the university believed him. The university did terminate his employment on a without cause basis, but only because they felt as though because they had to conduct the investigation, the employment couldn't continue. But they did believe in the employee's integrity. They didn't believe the allegations, and that's why they negotiated a severance agreement that provided the employee with 36 months of gross salary, which is about $696,000. So pretty substantial separation package. And the reason why it was so big is because they believed the employee's representation that he did not engage in this misconduct. So later, so the university conducts the investigation, and they conclude that in May 2011, that's after, you know, the severance package agreement has been reached, after the employee has been terminated, and the university found and concluded that the former employee had devised and carried out numerous fraudulent schemes. It basically verified the truth of the allegations. The employer brought a claim against the employee seeking to rescind the severance agreement as well as the mutual agreement. So basically they were like, oh my goodness, this guy stole a ton of money from us. We should have never come to that agreement in the first place. How do we get out of paying him just under $700,000? So the question is, did the court order the employer to pay out the settlement money, or did they find that the employer had after acquired cause? If you guess that they ordered the employer to pay out the settlement, you're wrong. So this is kind of a happy-ish ending. The trial judge and the Ontario Court of Appeal confirmed that as a fiduciary, the employee had a positive obligation to disclose the full extent of his fraudulent activity before he entered into the severance agreement. The employee's intentional and material nondisclosure entitled the university to set aside the severance agreement. I always find this case a little bit interesting because they were aware of like the allegations, but I guess they just believed him and they believed his representation. So the court, I think, wanted to find a way to rescind the severance agreement. So they basically said that where one party induces another to enter into agreement by making a material misrepresentation, in this case, it was the individual saying, no, I didn't conduct any fraud, the appropriate remedy is rescission.
Yeah, and I almost think maybe in this case, the court thought that like the employer did the right thing by not just like relying upon some allegations terminate for cause, because they didn't have all the proof there. Because as you can appreciate, if the guy kind of didn't do the fraud and they kind of relied upon the allegations to terminate him for cause, as you can see from some of the other cases, it's very possible that if they went that route, then they would have been whacked with aggravated and punitive damages. And so this is a way for the court to almost say, you did the right thing by not relying upon allegations alone to assert a kind of just cause. And once you realize that those allegations were true, we're going to let you out of that deal, because had you known that those allegations were true at the time of the termination, that would have been just cause. And I think it is an interesting case for sure for that reason. So just in conclusion, and this is probably the shortest e-learning that we've done in a very long time, so you'll have an extra 15 minutes or so to eat your lunches and stuff like that. But all these cases do highlight that litigation is uncertain. So even if you got one of the cases wrong, or you were leaning, or you weren't sure, that's what litigation is like. It's not always cut and dry. And so that's a very important kind of takeaway here. We can reduce that uncertainty by doing a few things. One, using valid employment contracts. And so we want, again, make sure there's offer, acceptance, and valid consideration for those contracts. The timing of how those contracts are entered into is very important. The termination provisions in those contracts are very important. And so all of that leads us to the second point. It's important to get professional advice when you're doing things, so that's when you're entering into these contracts or before you decide to let someone go. Oftentimes, one of the questions that we ask is, are there any skeletons in the closet? Meaning, is there anything else that makes this more difficult than it needs to be? And oftentimes, when that question is asked, we do find out that there are some issues that we need to address or account for when we give our advice. And so that's important. Always seek advice. The other thing to keep in mind is it's always good to have kind of proper human resources infrastructure in place. What we're talking about is the employee handbook. It's very important to have a kind of detailed employee handbook that outlines what the expectations are, all of that sort of stuff kind of surrounding the employment relationship. And lastly, I guess, just always treat your staff with kind of dignity and respect. Because if you don't, there is the potential that you could be whacked with additional additional damages awarded against you. So just those are the four takeaways. If there's any particular questions, you know you don't have to go it alone. We are here to help you through your issues, so never hesitate to reach out to us. To talk about anything, we are here to help. A reminder again, if you missed it off the top, our next e-learning is going to be May 29th, where our HR kind of lead advisor and our recruitment specialist will be talking about all things recruitment and interviewing. That's such an important kind of subject matter. So on behalf of myself and Alexandra, we want to thank you for taking the time to spend with us today. And we look forward to speaking with you really soon. Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Guys.